Good morning, and welcome to the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship of Manhattan, Kansas. My name is Michael Oldfather. Kathleen and I are sharing the role of convener for this morning's service. Following a long-standing tradition, we make it clear to visitors and to ourselves as well that being a welcoming congregation means that we do not discriminate on the basis of gender, ethnicity, sexual orientation, wealth, political affiliation, education, age, or anything else that might divide us into competing camps. However welcoming we strive to be, last Sunday, Reverend Johnstone cautioned visitors that this might not be a good fit for everyone by quoting one Donald Ernest Alley, who discovered UUism in prison. "If you need a church that tells you what to believe," he said, "this is probably not the church you should attend." Questioning is deeply embedded in our DNA. We have lots of questions, the answers to which are subject to modification when new information and new insights demand that we do so. And I didn't have any announcements given to me, but there are several in the Sunday bulletin, and I trust that you will read them carefully and commit them to memory. We now my cohort and me, we move here. Incidentally, because of a job she has here, she has taken off her wedding ring. Guys, don't get any ideas. It's just temporary. And how we're going to handle this.
Okay, we're going to do a responsive reading, and we'd like you to join us. Number 729, it's called The Winds of Summer. And if you have a higher voice, mine's not real high, but it's higher than his. If you have a high voice, do the first part with me. And if you have a lower voice.
If you have a lower voice, you join with me in the italicized portions. Okay?
Okay.
All right.
All right. The Winds of Summer. You and I and all of us blew about with the winds of summer,
following the sun in different ways of freedom and play,
finding rest in the cool stillness of shadows and moving to the slow, heart-struck rhythms which turn the long hours of summer light.
Now it is time for gathering in. We come together at this time and in this place on the bridge of autumn.
Summer is fading backward into memory, and winter waits in snowy brilliance.
We meet with eagerness and delight, needing one another for sharing.
We have joys and sorrows and hopes to share, questions and things we care about and want to help make better.
Things that we would like to understand, ideas waiting to be heard.
Today we are all together in gladness, once more the special community that we call our church.
A community of all ages that sings its songs, tells its thoughts, asks its questions, and searches together with courage and with love. And now it is the opening hymn. Is number 797. It is the Star of Truth. 297, thank you, 297. And a group of us will come to the front here and sing it together, and then the first verse, and then you can join us for the next three. How's that?
Thank you. kids come up now?
Yeah.
Children of heart.
Children of any age, children of heart of any age are invited up to help participate the next stage of this.
All service. Right, Ronan, and you are just in time. Okay. Now we're gonna need a little. Oh no! Oh no! We forgot something. We forgot something. We sang and what did we forget? I heard somebody out there say it. Did anybody else hear it? The chalice! We forgot to light the chalice!
I didn't even get a reading.
Oh, no, we don't even have a reading. Oh. I know. You all can help us create a chalice lighting for the chalice, okay? All right, that's what we'll do. You can just help us create a chalice lighting. So why do we light the chalice? Okay, I guess I have to answer this question. We light the chalice to help us remember what our highest and best values are. We light the chalice to remind us of the vision that we're moving toward. And vision is our theme this month. So that's an important piece. Vision is our theme. And so we're going to light the chalice to try to remember our vision, to try to remember our ideals, what we're striving for. So who has some ideas of some words that we might use in the chalice lighting? Kathleen will write them down for us. Oh, what if we started out with, we light this chalice for what? Oh, come on. I know you all have the ideas. No ideas? What do you think? What do you think are some of our values?
What do we care about?
What do we care about? Equity. Does everybody know what equity means? Is that kind of like fairness? Fairness? Okay, what else?
Compassion.
Compassion, that's a good one. Does anybody out there have any of them? Any ideas?
Love.
Okay, love. Any other ideas?
Truth.
Humility.
Any other ideas? Do you all have any ideas? The owl? Well, what does the owl have? Huh? It has a bow. What are owls known for? They're known for being wise, so maybe for wisdom. Could we light it for wisdom? So how are we coming, Kathleen? Do we have kind of a chalice lighting there, maybe? Okay, why don't you read them out and we'll repeat them.
Okay. All right, we light this chalice for... Say that.
We light this chalice for...
Equity and fairness.
Equity and fairness.
Compassion.
Compassion.
Love.
Love.
Truth.
Truth.
Humility.
Humility.
And wisdom.
Shine your light in all you do. Oh, in peace. peace of our hearts go with you. Go in joy, our hopes go to. Learn in love and grow in wisdom. Shine your light in all you do.
While the are you doing the opening of that? Okay, all right. No, not yet. You don't do it till after the offertory.
Oh. Follow the map.
Uh-oh.
Okay. This is a reading that comes from this book, Growing a Beloved Community, which 12 Hallmarks of a Healthy Congregation is what this comes from. Okay. Just an excerpt from a chapter. The chapter's referred to as Look Back, Around, and Ahead. In pursuit of the beloved community, the past is cherished, the present is celebrated, and the future is charted. Robust congregations pay homage to those spiritual comrades who have come before and honors those not yet born, remembering that our mission is to give succeeding generations the precious gift of tomorrow. A vital church ensures that all children, youth, and adults, everyone in its communal circle become familiar with the history of Unitarian Universalism and with the chronicle of their particular religious outpost. A lively congregation rummages regularly in its archives. While it's important to look back with gratitude and ahead in anticipation, a healthy church expends the bulk of its energy looking around in the present moment. Churches that live in the present are content communities, yet never satisfied ones. They remain in motion, sometimes commotion, perpetually trying to improve and evolve. They walk the narrow rail between serenity and smugness. They aren't dreaming about yesterday or fantasizing about tomorrow. They travel with the essential resources they have and the gathered people they are. Healthy congregations look ahead, charting the future. The responsibility of shared ministry is to produce a communal vision that includes yet transcends the different viewpoints of members. A vision without a task is a dream, is but a dream. A task without a vision is drudgery. A vision with a task is the hope of the world. The real division between healthy and ailing congregations is between the energetic, the buoyant, and the hopeful on one hand, and the enervated, the cynical, and those who are devoid of vision on the other. Hopers are activated human beings who arouse in self and others a passion for the possible. Hopers are realists, harboring no illusions about the arduousness of growing the beloved community. Augustine remarked, "Hope has two beautiful daughters. Their names are anger and courage. Anger at the way things are, and courage to see that they don't remain the way they are. Human dignity ultimately lies not in our innocence or goodness, so much as in the mantle to forge new beginnings, in bona fide struggles born of anger and courage. 7 times down and 8 times up. I love that. 7 times down and 8 times up. That's what hope is all about. And it is a basic nutrient of strong congregations that eagerly cherish the past, celebrate the present, and chart the future." And now, we'll have the offertory. I didn't prepare any particular words, did you? So we'll pass around the baskets. Renee will play a lovely piece for us. And we thank you for what you can share with us today. Okay, and John Alou will collect any joys and concerns that you would like to write or have written on the little white sheets of paper. Thank you.
Beautiful. Thank you. That's a joy. We read this morning that we have joys and sorrows and hopes to share. And there is a joy this morning from Katie Kingery Page that her dear friend and kid's godmother, Kathy, is visiting from Kansas City and has joined us this morning. And thanks to Kathy, they spent the weekend floating in the lake, searching for fossils and enjoying the Flint Hills. The Flint Hills. I remind us, too, that we want to remember this morning, because it's Labor Day weekend, the workers of all kinds, and the workers who, through the years, have given us, have worked to give us the rights in terms of work that we have. They're people who we should remember this weekend.
A personal vision journey. Just before my 50th birthday, the head of hematology at KU Med told me I had a 50-50 chance of making it to celebrate my 60th birthday. To paraphrase Samuel Johnson, knowing a man is headed for the gallows concentrates his mind wonderfully. I decided to eliminate as much of the stressful aspects of my life as I could and focus the freed-up time to do more of the things I enjoyed most. My first step was to shed as much of the time-consuming and stressful elements of my job as possible, along with the compensation they represented, to devote more time to family, music, and volunteer activities most reflective of my values. Some of that extra time went to returning to active involvement in Democratic Party politics. But an even bigger share of time and energy focused on getting involved right here. Prior to accepting a very demanding K-State job and moving to Manhattan in 1983, I had belonged to 5 different UU congregations, ranging in size from 20 to members to over 300. It was time to reenlist. Because of 2 busy schedules and a young son to care for, Kathleen and I had been only marginally attached here. But that changed for the 3 of us in the early 1990s, and that's when my vision formed for what might be possible here. There were about 40 members, beautifully conceived RE program serving very few children, no professional leadership, and a charming but modest building set on this lovely site. I envisioned more members, perhaps 150 to 200 of them. Lots of kids in noisy, stimulating RE program, a bigger building here or elsewhere to accommodate all of this, fairly compensated professional staff of a full-time minister, RE and music directors, and whatever else was needed to keep the ship afloat. We're not there yet, but I'm unwilling to throw in the towel because of what we have accomplished in the past 27 years. What follows chronicles some of the highlights of that journey. In 1993, the Topeka Fellowship approached us with a plan to share a minister to serve the 2 congregations. The minister's time and salary, partially funded by the UUA, would be divided so that Topeka would have a 3-quarter time minister and we would have a 1-quarter time minister, 1 sermon a month, and quite a bit more. A committee, Bert Forster, Florence Schwab and I, was charged with the task of meeting with our counterparts in Topeka and to work out the details of the arrangement and to bring the proposal to the membership for an up or down vote. Early in 1994, we submitted that proposal to the congregation, but before doing so, Bernd and I lined up 8 or 9 people who agreed to increase their pledges sufficiently to support the additional costs, about $10,000 a year. Following a spirited congregational discussion, our participation was approved by a vote somewhere in the neighborhood of 28 to 4. Getting the money is probably a good idea. Later that year, we welcomed Reverend David Grimm to serve as our quarter-time minister. When he left Manhattan 10 years later, our membership had grown from 40 to 100 members, adults, this sanctuary, the narthex, the new kitchen, a fine grand piano, and the old kitchen had been repurposed as a pastor's study, and the RE program was flourishing. Our budgeting and pledging operations were greatly improved. Backing up a bit, the co-chairs of the committee to raise the funds for the construction of the building expansion were Bryce Holbrook and Nancy Perkins. They were fantastic, and members were very generous. By the time we had moved into this new space in June of 2002, we had spent some $400,000 on the expansion. About $200,000 of it came from some small grants and members' donations. another $100,000 came from our endowment. The remainder of the project was financed by a bank loan of $100,000. A little more about the loan shortly. With David's departure in 2004, we began searching for a replacement. The short story is that we hired Michael Nelson to begin at a 42%, that is 5/12 times minister. That's what happened in this room. The debate went on from a quarter to over a half, and we settled on 5/12. Along the way, he was at 60% for most of his years with us. Along the way, we raised contributions in the neighborhood of $20,000 to build in blacktop the parking lot at the bottom of the hill. But back to the construction note. By 2007, which coincided with the fellowship's 50th anniversary, we'd paid it down to about $70,000. To mark the occasion, a group of us promoted a burn the mortgage campaign to retire the debt and redirect the roughly $1,200 a month we were paying the bank to use for other purposes. In less than a month's efforts, the note was gone. After Michael Nelson retired, the board provided inspired leadership to get us to full-time ministry, first for a three-year contract, and beginning just a couple of weeks ago for a second three-year term. A sizable piece of my vision has become reality, but more of it remains. I'm thinking of the Ames, Iowa UU congregation as a model for what else might be possible here. There are differences between Ames and Manhattan, to be sure. Ames' population is 17% greater than ours, and Iowa State is somewhat more focused on corn and hogs, while KSU concentrates on wheat and cattle. But both of them are their state's land-grant university. The Ames congregation has 226 members. If we could attract a similar percentage of our population, we would have 193 members instead of 115. I remain convinced that UUFM membership of well over 150 people like us is both possible and highly desirable. We need more members to support full-time ministry and the cost of increasing our space. But much more importantly, there are dozens of our neighbors who may not know it, but they and their families need a liberal religious home even more than we need them. Our hymn is number 168, One More Step. Please stand as you are able. Join us in singing it.
One more. It's easy to mix something you're not looking for. Okay, honest, who counted the 13 passes? I only got 12. And who saw the moonwalking bear the first time around? Good job, Chris Bailey. I only counted 12 passes, and I missed the moonwalking bear, and I've never claimed to be good at attention to detail. But this public service, public service announcement was made to remind people of cyclists on the road, but it does more than that. It reminds us to what extent we see what we are looking for, and we do not see what we are not looking for, which is really relevant for the topic of vision. Vision, of course, is this month's theme. And we're not talking about literal eyesight, the ability to see. We are speaking of the abstract sense of foresight and perception, charting a direction. And it's important to recognize that someone does not have to be able to see in order to have vision of this sort. I think, for example, of a colleague of mine, Gerald Davis, an African-American originally ordained as a Black Baptist who converted to UUism and has served the Church of the Restoration, a very small UU congregation in Tulsa, Oklahoma, that was started in 1987 in Greenwood. As a deliberately racially mixed congregation. Greenwood is the area that once was recognized as the Black Wall Street until the infamous Tulsa race riot in the 1920s when whites massacred and stole from the black area, destroying that neighborhood to a great extent. And the church never took off the way that people had hoped, but Gerald shifted their vision to being an anchor of the community, a place that houses a Muslim congregation and interfaith efforts, that has a labyrinth outside for anyone to walk. You see, Gerald has vision, but he doesn't have sight. He's been blind for decades. So we don't want you to take the visual imagery too literally, even if it is helpful as a metaphor. Howard Gardner, the Harvard professor of education who developed the theory of multiple intelligences, discusses how spatial intelligence, which is usually seen as a visual skill, plays out for people without sight. They use touch or sound as a method to gauge where things are and how they are moving. I've heard stories of how they're increasingly using almost a sonar-like ability to put sounds out and tell where to locate themselves. So that remains a kind of vision, finding where they are and where they're going. So we're not talking about the visual sense, even as we use metaphors that remind us of that sense, but we are talking about a kind of vision that is setting a direction, navigating into the future. It's said that the people of the Caroline Islands in Micronesia can navigate their boats in the ocean without instruments. Instead, they memorize the position of the stars in each segment of their journey, and they know in relation to the particular island they are near where the stars should be, and they compare their mental picture with what they see in front of them to determine where they are and what adjustments they may need to make in their course. So similarly, when we have a vision, we have a mental picture of what should be, our ideals, to compare to the actual picture in front of us, what we're seeing, and see how to make adjustments. Now, we've already learned, though, this morning, that we may not be completely reliable in what we see in front of us. We may miss the moonwalking bear. To accurately chart a direction, you have to see clearly and well where you are. And that's the awareness piece. So most of us flunked that because we were focused on one thing. We missed everything else, or very nearly everything else. And so that's part of what I'm calling a lens. In our eyes, the lens focuses light on the retina. And to do that, the light has to be bent. And all kinds of lenses bend light one way or another so that our focus can be where we want it to be. A convex lens, like a telescope or binoculars, makes light converge so that images appear bigger. A concave lens, like a projector, bends light outward. So lenses distort light. We're always seeing a version of what is really there, but we're not seeing what is actually there. A lot of times we think we're seeing what is actually there. We're seeing a version of what is actually there. And it's so easy to forget that. So moving into the abstract area of vision again, we never see what's actually there. We see it through some kind of lens. Most often we see it through a compound lens, a combination of different lenses. Now in the video we watched, the announcer set up a lens, a focus, by asking us to count the number of times players in white passed the ball. If he hadn't done that, then more of us would have seen the moonwalking bear the first time. In real life, there are other ways that lenses get set up, and much of the time we're unaware of them. We see what we expect to see. It even has a name, observer bias. Scientists, of course, structure experiments in ways to limit observer bias. In our everyday lives, that's harder. That means that based on our previous experience, our peculiar set of beliefs, in short, what we focus on, we will see different things. So one example of this is when you learn a new word and suddenly start hearing it everywhere. The thing is, the word was probably there before, but because you didn't know it, you didn't hear it or see it. Now that you know it, your awareness has shifted. It's like watching the basketball video the second time. Of course you see the moonwalking bear then, because you're looking for it. So we witness this phenomenon of seeing what we expect to see in today's political realm. Fox News sees things that reinforce its view of the world. MSNBC sees things that reinforce its view of the world. It's self-perpetuating, and we all are caught up in it because we are all human. So let's talk about some of our lenses and how lenses work. Mark Williams, who founded the Diversity Channel, he's a diversity trainer. He speaks of 10 different lenses through which people in America see race. He has names for them: assimilationist, colorblind, cultural centrist, elitist, integrationist, meritocratist, multiculturalist, secularist, transcendent, and victim caretaker. The labels, though, they don't matter that much. And I don't even want to go into those lenses in detail, but I do want to share how he talks about how these lenses work, because that process really applies broadly. Each lens, he says, has its strengths and weaknesses. So each of the lenses that we see the world through has its strengths and weaknesses. No perspective is entirely right or entirely wrong. And that's a tough one sometimes, to not judge those lenses. Well, then he says this, which I think applies to all kinds of lenses we use in interpreting our world. The challenge is that when we become locked into a particular lens or lenses, the door to understanding and cultural richness closes. When we become locked into a particular lens, the door to understanding closes. And William says, "My greatest hope is that the lens's concept will offer a key to open this door so that individuals can reach out to one another across differences. So he goes on to describe how lenses come out of legacies and layers. Our legacies come from what we were taught by our families and what we've seen our people live through. What we've inherited. Layers are added through personal experiences and identities, where we're from and our religious affiliation, our education, gender and sexuality, family connections. All of these and more shape the legacies that we've been given, and they create our particular lenses. Not everyone will prioritize a particular identity in the same way. So even if two people share a lot of similarities, they may have subtle differences in their lenses in how they see the world. And everything looks different through a different lens. Have you ever seen those magazine covers where the picture shifts as you change angle? That's because they actually put lenses in there. It's lenticular printing. The picture looks like it's shifting. It isn't really. It's just a lens. So there was a time when our culture pretty thoroughly embraced the Enlightenment or modern view of objectivity. Today, we're better at acknowledging that truth is multiple rather than singular. And it's defined to some degree by point of view, that no one is free of a point of view. And I like the story of the three umpires to describe the differences. Do you know the story of the three umpires? The first umpire proclaims, there's balls and there's strikes, and I calls them as they are. Now, this traditionalist does not realize that their view is shaped by anything except the ball and where it is in space. The second umpire announces, there's balls and there's strikes, and I calls them as I sees them. Now, this modernist realizes that they're an observer doing the best to describe reality. And the third umpire declares, they ain't nothing till I call them. Thus, reality, balls and strikes, are defined and constructed by the observer. And that's fine until two observers see and call different things because they have different lenses, different perspectives. And that's why it's become more common in the academic world for people to identify the perspective from which they come as they offer their interpretation. It helps to remind me when I name those perspectives. It helps for me to recognize that I speak as a white woman, born in the 1950s, a lesbian, an American from the South, a former Southern Baptist, a Unitarian Universalist minister. Each of these things shapes my lens. And I have to begin to understand how that lens may distort what I see. Now, those of you who wear glasses, have you ever suddenly realized that you weren't seeing very well and you cleaned your glasses and, miracle of miracles, you see again? Sometimes we have to do that with abstract vision, too. You see, we have to see what crud is built up on our lenses that distort what's in front of us. It's bad enough to be stuck on a single vision. It's worse if the vision has been distorted. And remember what William said? The challenge is when we become locked into a particular lens or lenses. We need some facility with shifting how we are looking at the world, or we'll end up stuck in untenable situations. Have you ever been working at a problem, pounding and pounding away at it, and getting nowhere because you keep trying the same solution different ways, and it keeps not working? And then, for some reason, you step back and look at it from a different angle and say, oh, This is what I need to do. Now, part of that might be dismantling whatever you were working on to get it just right, but you were focused, so focused on a particular thing that you didn't see the way to actually solve the problem. You were focused on what you thought would work. So that's one reason for recognizing our lenses. They can limit our sight. We may need a different lens to look through. Another is that it helps me understand why I may not see things the same way you see things. And that can help me understand you better. It can help me understand the overall situation better if I can see it both from my perspective and yours. If you can describe what it looks like from your perspective, through your lens, then together we may be better able to come closer to the truth than with a single lens. So the magic comes when we have different people with different lenses. And that makes our sight less fallible, our own way of looking at it more reliable. So once we've practiced describing to others what we see in front of us, we can learn to describe what we are moving toward. Sometimes those are individual goals and directions. And sometimes in a family or in a congregation, as Michael spoke of earlier, they're joint goals that we're working on together. In either instance, there's another skill to learn: how to move our focus from the immediate present day to the future and back seamlessly. This is a little like looking at something close up and far away. Like, I'm looking down at the words in my manuscript and up at you to see if I'm communicating. And it turns out that our eyes are actually exceptionally good at doing this. We do it all the time when we're driving, for example. You check the speedometer, look back down the road, squint at a close-up street marker, shift back to the road ahead, measure in your mind whether the light blocks ahead is going to turn red before you get there. You notice the car in front of you putting on its brakes. Over and over, we shift from what's right in front of us to what's down the road. We do that all the time when we're driving. And that's really, it's an amazing miracle, these eyes that we have, this biology that we have. It's really hard to do that with equipment. Have you ever tried to do that kind of shifting with a telescope or binoculars to move from close up to far away? It's really hard. And any of you wear bifocals? It took an adjustment period to learn how to use them, where to look for what view. So in a similar way, when we have a vision for the future, we have to constantly look back and forth between that vision out there and what's in front of us. At the same time that we're listening to others describe what's in front of them so that we can have a broader picture of what's here, and maybe describing what they're seeing out there in the distance. So that's a lot to process. So we're comparing all of these things, the future that we see, the future others see, how all of it fits in with our vision. So, and then we have to think, okay, on what adjustments in navigation do we need? This is complicated stuff. So, why even bother? Why even bother? Because we have to. We have to. Because we see the world as it is. We see our lives as they are. And we imagine the world as it should be. We imagine our lives as they should be. And they're not the same. We human beings are born wanting something more than we have. We can misinterpret that and misdirect it, thinking that we want to accumulate money or power for its own sake. But if we're in touch with our highest values, the values that bring us together, values like justice and love and equality, then we know we have to do something. Maybe it's to raise our children to be just and loving. Maybe it's to bring beauty into the world through art. Maybe it's to equip students to bring their talents to the world. Maybe it's to heal people or to make the criminal justice system more just or to sow kindness. The key is we see what is and imagine what could be, and from that comes our vision. The megachurch minister T.D. Jakes says that vision should be a little annoying. It's annoying because it reminds us that the world is not as it should be, that our lives are not as they should be, that there is something else for us to do. The more time and energy we spend with that vision, the more annoying and uncomfortable it becomes because we're not living in it now. Remember what Henry David Thoreau said, though. If you've built castles in the air, your work need not be lost. That is where they should be. Now, put the foundations under them. So the next step after you have that vision is building the foundations under the castles in the air. As Kathleen read in this morning's reading, a vision without a task is but a dream. A castle in the air. A vision without a task without a vision is drudgery. A vision with a task is the hope of the world. So there's a story of three medieval stoneworkers. I'm into these stories of three today somehow. So the three medieval stoneworkers asked what he was doing. One said, "I'm working my tail off hauling these heavy stones, placing them and replacing them, nothing but grinding drudgery." The second stoneworker at the same task had a different attitude. "I'm making a respectable living to take care of my family." The third stoneworker, though, had a vision. He said, "I'm building a cathedral to the glory of God." I'm thinking that the third guy was the happiest. And we may not be interested in building a cathedral to the glory of God, but we certainly can admire the beauty and wonder these long-ago stonemasons brought into the world. The cathedral at Cologne took more than 600 years to build, way beyond the lifetimes of anyone who worked on it. Yet there was a vision, or probably over the years, visions, dreams through the centuries, shared by countless people who contributed, who participated in the dream. Even when our visions, our individual goals, they fit together in the puzzle that is our communal life, our goals and dreams merge and complete those of members of our family, our co-workers, our neighborhood, our city, our congregations, sometimes in explicit ways and sometimes not. A cathedral has a concrete, solid being, and most of our visions are more abstract, harder to see and touch. Yet we participate in bringing them to life, making of our lives more than they could be without the vision. We create a world as it should be, together. Other people's lenses and perspectives contribute to our work as we listen to them. So I wonder what dreams and visions you have. what dreams and visions do you bring to your lives? What dreams and visions do you bring to this place? What dreams and visions do you bring to this community? And with that, I will open it up. No one has any dreams or visions. Oh.
Oh, it's her again.
Who's her?
Well,
who is her?
Her vision.
Yeah, but she has a name, right?
Yes, this is Diane Barker. My vision is to stop trying to act and instead to achieve the humility to fit in, to stop striving in ways that after you get started, they turn out to be very destructive and probably counter to your heart, to your true nature. And when you were giving us the analogy of driving, you know, I went, rearview mirror, look in the rearview mirror.
Oh, yeah, right, right.
Don't
I forgot
forget
that
the rearview mirror because you live the past. You can't outrun your previous actions and thoughts, nor those of your ancestors. So I feel like I'm trying to deconstruct the colonial view that I learned of who I am as a human being and always merge myself. Like at the lake today, I was with the bluebirds and listening to their voices. And there's a tree. I sit in its shade. And a man taught me how when you sit in the shade of a tree, you are sitting within its being, and it's influencing you. And so I find that my vision is to back off from building ugly, monstrous houses that take more energy than they really should, to instead try to dance with things, see them, be with them, listen to them, and let that change my vision of what I am and who I am and how I am connecting with my relations all around me. Aho.
That's a beautiful vision.
Hi, good morning. I'm Katie Kingery Page. I want to share a brief story, and then it will lead to what my vision is for us. And it might sound like a humble vision. We'll see. Jonalu, you got me thinking with discussion of the difference between sight and vision. And I started thinking about this wonderful story. It's part of a book collected by the National Federation of the Blind. And the story goes like this. There's a young couple with children, and they become part of a church congregation. They're never asked to volunteer or do anything because they're blind, and all of their fellow congregants assume that they will not be able to make meaningful contributions. In spite of that, they won't let their gifts and talents be unseen, no pun intended, so they sign up to be on the coffee and greeting crew. The first day that they're to work to do that weekend, the others on the greeting crew are ill and call them that morning and say, "We're sorry, we can't be there to help you. Here's some names of people that you could call to be sure that everything can get done. We're so sorry we're leaving you two, without help." The couple decides to call no one, and they come in, and they do everything needed, and everything is spotless and perfect, and the coffee is the most delicious anyone has ever tasted that day. And they teach their congregation a lesson about assuming what their worth or their ability was. The story goes on, and a couple years later in these young people's lives, some no doubt well-meaning and even most certainly misplaced concerns from someone in their children's school decides to challenge their parental rights, assuming they can't be competent parents as blind people. And it's that same church congregation that first thought that they were not useful that stands up for their parental rights and says, there's no one better fit to be a parent than this. What if they had sat back, though, and not made their gifts and talents perceived by others? So my hope and vision for us as a congregation is that no one will accept anything they may feel that dismisses their gifts and talents and bring them forward and keep bringing them forward until they're seen and fully realized.
Hi, I'm Barbara Bascom, and spent a large part of my life my professional life in the country of Romania, working with children in orphanages. And I had a big vision about what I might accomplish there. I was on a plane on my way back to Romania to start a program, and I was upgraded to middle class or whatever. Anyway, I was sitting next to this, I thought, very wealthy-looking, accomplished gentleman, and he turned and looked at me, and he said, I'm so-and-so. I would like to know something. And I said, what's that? And he said, what have you done today to make the world a better place? And that really set me back. I had great visions and great plans. I was facing an almost impossible tragedy with children who were incarcerated. Does that term ring true today for some of you? And removed from their families and placed in institutions which were terribly neglectful and cruel. And I was supposed to make that better, and I was well-funded. But I began to change at that moment. And instead of the grand plan and the big vision of and the TV programs and the fame and the awards, I would just forget about myself. And every day I would do one thing that would make those places a better place for children. And I think that's a really good rule when you're talking about visions, is to scale down the grand vision, take yourself out of it, and just do one thing every day to make that world a better place.
Our visions can easily get tied into ego, and that's a problem. Yeah, I agree.
Gene Severs. This may be old news. I saw it on CBS Sunday morning, just this morning. But they claimed Microsoft was one of the larger companies that specifically went out of their way to hire autistic employees. And they went on to explain how that was very beneficial and meeting some different needs that they had was the best thing for everybody involved, and that supposedly there's quite a few different big companies that are falling into that realization.
Any other visions?
My name is Sylvia Beeman. I don't know if this is more like a personal challenge, but this one of the founding members of the fellowship, Cecil Miller, he once said in a very elegant way, which I can't remember exactly, why would I go on a walk with someone just like myself? And so meaning that you have something to learn when you break out of your box and associate with people or ideas or challenges that shake you up or aren't just exactly safe. But I'm kind of drawn to do things that, like to unusual people and things that are scary. But I also want to be safe, but I think about what Cecil said a lot and challenge myself to do some things that aren't necessarily the safest, easiest things that I might want to do.
I'm Harriet Yonke, and since Jean said that, it reminded me when we visited some friends in Portland, Oregon this summer, and the two young ones worked for Intel, and they said that, and they're from Iraq, Baghdad, the parents were, and they said in their program development circles, I think they called them, the company places as many different countries, different nationalities as possible in each pod or whatever, that they people from different countries, nationalities, ways of doing things, have different ways of thinking or different ways of doing, and that brings a lot more experience, a lot more ideas to these development of programs. My response was, could you put an 80-year-old lady in there, too, that could tell you this is not intuitive?
Different lenses.
Hi, I'm Taryn Sipra, and I was reading a book. It's called F Feelings, only they say the actual word. But in it, it actually said one of the addictions possible was being a helpaholic, and I just started as a TRIO academic specialist, and we serve underserved citizens and students, and I have felt the most drained and exhausted that I've ever felt in my life, because I never wanted to be in social services because I knew I do this. But now that I see it as like an addiction, and John Alou said that one of the lenses you can see the world through is a victim caregiver. And I'm like, wow, so this really is something to explore. Maybe that's how I see myself and I can change my roles. And then if we like look at the church, I'm kind of wondering if we shouldn't do like reflections online, or like our joys and sorrows are now like being posted in our listserv. Maybe we could all do like reflections after the service or something and share with the broader online community so that our congregation grows. That was my vision.
Wow. Okay.
Thank you. I'm Lily Colburn. I am someone who's very intentional about goal setting and vision, and I'll actually talk about this more next week, so that's a plug for that, but when I give the service. Anyway, I'm someone who, especially in the past few years, have known specifically what I wanted to do and where I wanted to go. Some of that has changed, but in this time of transition in my life where I have no idea what I'll be doing next week, let alone in 4 years, I sat down a few weeks ago to write out my goals at the beginning of the school year, like I have done for a while, and had no idea what my vision was, which has been really interesting, discovering that I usually took joy in the big plans and what that meant my future was and what that related to my identity, but I'm now transitioning to a more present-based, well, I'll get through this class and this day, and that's my vision for now.
So sometimes shifting from the long view back to the close view is helpful.
So we've had a few conversations about different companies here in the U.S., and so I wanted to touch on Joann Fabrics. I don't know if you guys know this, but when they initially opened, they sold cheese, and their initial vision was to be one of the best corporations in America and be available coast to coast selling cheese. But what happened is their customer base ended up liking the fabric that they wrapped their cheese in more than the cheese that they sold. So they shifted their vision in order to reach their goals, and I believe that that is absolutely okay to do.
Fabulous. Fabulous. Well, let me close here with a portion of the poem, A Brave and Startling Truth by Maya Angelou, because I cannot say it as well as she does. When we come to it, we, this people, on this minuscule and kithless globe who reach daily for the bomb, the blade, and the dagger, yet who petition in the dark for tokens of peace. We, this people, on this mote of matter in whose mouths abide cantankerous words which challenge our very existence, yet out of some of those same mouths come songs of such exquisite sweetness that the heart falters in its labor and the body is quieted into awe. We, this people on this small and drifting planet whose hands can strike with such abandon that in a twinkling life is sapped from the living, yet those same hands can touch with such healing, irresistible tenderness, that the haughty neck is happy to bow and the proud back is glad to bend out of such chaos, of such contradiction. We learn that we are neither devils nor divines when we come to it. We, these people, on this wayward, floating body created on this earth, of this earth, have the power to fashion for this earth a climate where every man and every woman can live freely, without sanctimonious piety, without crippling fear. When we come to it, we must confess that we are the possible. We are the miraculous. The true wonder of this world, that is when and only when we come to it. Let us lift our voices now in song. Number 146, our closing hymn, tells us that soon the day will arrive. So rise in body or spirit to sing with enthusiasm. Embrace the vision, a world without fear, a world without violence, a world with justice, a world with compassion. May we bring it into being by living it more and more every day in big ways and small. May you find the blessing of justice, compassion, and love in your home, in your heart, in your life. So may it be. Amen.